Louise, before I get into it, could I just ask you quickly something you mentioned some months ago, which is this has huge implications for institutional religions as it recommends involvement in politics.
As it recommends?
Yes. In other words, you had said to me that the Catholic bishops all in unison said, we need to vote this way. And yet the laity didn't.
You sure you're quoting me on that?
I do remember. I love that. That's why I asked you to speak.
I mean, the Catholic bishops made some clear signals, but I don't remember them telling anybody.
No, not how to vote, but they made clear signals, and I think you were just saying the point that the data shows that even when they make clear signals, this problem with institutional affiliation, it creates a problem in them having the authority to sort of push.
I think that's right. I think religious authority writ large is being eroded across the religious spectrum. And I think there are several measures that point to that.
Okay, Rebecca, you're first, and then Eleanor.
Hi. So I wanted to say, first of all, I really appreciated the breakdown of the unaffiliated. This is something that, same thing happens when we cover independent voters every four years. People lump them all together as one big group. It's a shorthand. People have lots of different leanings and so on. I wanted to ask you two questions, one of which may be completely unanswerable. Both of them may be completely unanswerable, so I'm going to ask them anyway. So the first thing is, any Jewish American can tell you, Christmas is a lot more than a religious holiday in this country. Obviously, it's something that ties people together, ties families together, ties the culture together. You're almost celebrating it whether you want to or not. And then, on a related note, you have, as you saw, it's important for a president to have strong religious beliefs, all these people who say they're more likely to vote for a Muslim candidate than an atheist candidate. So what I was wondering was, how many of these unaffiliated people who say they have some religious leanings, some spiritual leanings, again, this may be completely unanswerable, how many of them may feel like either there's still some huge stigma to calling yourself agnostic, even though that's effectively what they are, and or they, by saying it, they're separating themselves from the larger culture, taking themselves out of the mainstream. And when they say, I want a president who has strong religious beliefs, what they're actually saying is, I want a president who's part of the mainstream culture in this country.
Yeah, no, it's excellent. We don't know what percentage of these marginals, if you want to call them, still continue to identify with a religion. My sense is, there are certain thresholds on these things, and once it gets to a certain, a percentage, people may just say, let it all rip, and you'll have these unaffiliated coming out of the woodwork. It's been increasing, pretty steadily. But on the, it's a fascinating question. You're absolutely right. There's a large number of Americans who cannot imagine voting for an atheist. A religious unaffiliated is a different proposition. And the question is, why is that? I actually think there's an intervening question we ask that may help to shed some light on that. And the question is it necessary to believe in God in order to be moral? Mm-hmm. Which gets at the link between religion and morality. And not surprisingly, for the vast majority of religious people, for whom their morality does come out of their religious convictions, can't imagine how you can reach some moral ground without starting off with religion. We find this, by the way, among Muslim groups who visit us all the time. We brief these groups on a regular basis on our research. You have to be very careful the way you use the word secular, because for many of these Muslim leaders, these are primarily the folks who come, secular means immoral, mm-hmm. right? Because no God, no morality. Right? That link is very quick. And so I think that's maybe what's going on here. If you ask the typical European that question, right, the balance is going to be, no, you don't have to believe in God to be moral. Americans are precisely in the other direction. You still have a significant majority who said, yeah, you know, you do have to believe in God to be moral. So I think that may be what's at play here, that for religious people, it's hard. You know, if you want a president that not only is about interest and power play, but that has some moral compass, for many religious people, that means, you know, you need to send us a signal that you take religion seriously.
Yeah. And, you have a follow-up. Right?
Yeah, just had a follow-up, and I mean, semi-related in the sense of the tying it to politics. When we looked at the, you know, the chart, and you see that spike after 1992, and obviously the shorthand is, you know, that was the height of the family values, culture wars, and so on. My question is, the generation that started coming of age then was the first that was born completely after, you know, the big cultural shift, the late 60s.
Right.
So how much of that might have occurred regardless of whether there was a culture war? And I mean, again, this is unanswerable, possibly,
No, but I do. I mean, it's an excellent point. And it gets to the Putnam thesis. How much of this phenomenon of disaffiliation would have continued, you know, would have occurred had there been no Christian right? I mean, that's the counterfactual you have to sort of work through. And I have to say that when I look at the broader dynamics that are going on in society, my hunch would be that, you know, we'd probably be seeing the identical same thing. That's not to say that when we do this polling, and I didn't get into some of this, but we ask people, we've come at it, we've given them a closed-ended question, we've given them open-ended questions. We just don't find the evidence, the direct evidence of people telling us, yep, I checked out of religion because religion had become too politicized or had become too conservative. We just don't see that in the direct evidence. I grant Putnam and Houghton Fisher that it's very, you know, the coincidence of the two is very suspicious. And then when you look at the political profile of the unaffiliated, it is a group that has serious issues, you know, with the Christian right. But whether, you know, one has led to the other, again, we just don't find the direct evidence. When I looked at the evidence, I think there's broader societal forces at work, which, you know, we can get into.
Okay, Eleanor, and then Michael Gerson, and then Paul. Eleanor, pull the mic over to you and make sure that little green light is on.
It is. One of the things I was wondering about was what you were saying about the life cycle change, mm-hmm. and how it's unlikely that that the millennial generation will become more religious as it ages. And I guess just my question on that was, how does that make sense along with some of the data you were showing us earlier about switching and people being who are unaffiliated, growing up in unaffiliated context,
right,
becoming more affiliated?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, if the unaffiliated constitute an ever-increasing percentage, won't that mean that a lot of their children, you have more children of the unaffiliated? Well, there's a couple of things. One, to say in passing that the unaffiliated American have the lowest fertility rate of any group. There's a strong connection in this country and abroad between level of religiosity and fertility rates. Take it to the bank. So they're going to have fewer of them, even though there may be, you know, a lot of unaffiliated folks, a lot fewer children. But again, Eleanor, the key is the net effect. Even if you have, you know, more children among the unaffiliated and more of them sort of become affiliated, the drift from the ranks of the affiliated, at least up until now, is just making up for all those losses. It's not even close. For the Catholics, I said for every four that were left, one entered through the front door. For the unaffiliated, it's almost precisely the reverse. For everyone who leaves, 3.25 or something like that, not quite 3.5, are coming in through the front door. So as long as you keep up those ratios, you know, you're going to have to bleed a lot of kids into the ranks of the affiliated to begin to make a difference.
Michael, pull the mic over, and you're up next.
Luis, let me ask you to step back historically just a little bit. And, one of the theories that came out of the Enlightenment is the secularization hypothesis.
Yes.
The idea that modernity inherently involves the decline of institutional religion. That didn't seem very credible in the 20th century.
Right.
With the rise of evangelicalism, Pentecostalism, Islam, you know, fundamentalist Hinduism, a lot of other things. But a lot of religious people are kind of fear that we're seeing a revenge of the secularization hypothesis in this type of data, that we all end up like Vermont, and then Vermont ends up like Sweden, and then, you know, we're, you know, that's where America is headed. And that seems, you know, heightened by the generational aspect of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But so how does that relate to the broader question, the tie between just modernity and the decline of institutional religion?
Yeah, that's really actually the – in fact, I'll show you a chart here to underscore what you're talking about. This is an analysis we did of, you know, countries throughout the world, and we have a religion scale. And it contains, you know, the importance of religion and prayer and two or three other variables, and then GMP per capita. And there is a strong connection between rising levels of material well-being and lower levels of religiosity, and particularly, you know, including disaffiliation, by the way. So, you know, the thing that strikes you about this is what an outlier the U.S. is, that you know, were it to conform to the general pattern, it would be below Western Europe in terms of religiosity, whereas, in fact, it fits comfortably with Latin America. So how do you account for that? And that's not just Latino immigrants, by the way. I know we're taking over the place, but I don't think you can just, well, Latin America's come here. It's a little more complicated than that. But that's what you're alluding to, that, in fact, what we may be seeing is delayed secularization, that, you know, what all of these European sociologists, you know, Weber and all the rest, when they looked at the world as Europe writ large, they were right, but not the timing was off in terms of the United States. I mean, that's the thesis. Well, the problem is that the data, and by the way, Americans sense what you just said. You know, I was going to point out here that two-thirds of Americans think that religion is losing influence. So they're resonating with the secularization theory, even though, you know, they don't get into the specifics of that stuff. And notice that the affiliated as well as the unaffiliated think that. You know, you have to go back, you know, to the early 70s after the Cultural Revolution in this country to find a higher percentage of Americans who said religion is losing influence. So clearly Americans believe that. The problem is, and you do see, Mike, some movement on some measures, you know, in the last, 10 years, an 8% drop in the percentage of people who believe in God with absolute certainty. You do see a little uptick in the percentage of Americans who seldom or never. Now, these are not major, but they're significant. Do I have another one? The importance of religion in people's lives. You know, it's remained pretty constant among those who say it's very important. What you see, though, at the same time, if I should have given you another line here showing the percentage of people who say it is not very important or not at all important. That number has ticked up. But those folks have come not from the ranks of this 60% of that would be decreasing. It's coming from the middle once again, right? So those folks, the liminals, you know, can't decide whether they're in or out. To the extent that they're opting for unaffiliation, right? So that creates, you know, the impression that the country is becoming more secular. In fact, what it's becoming is more polarized, religiously speaking. There's very little evidence that among that significant percentage of Americans for whom religion is very important, that you know, and who attend regularly, I mean, that number doesn't seem to be budging. All right, so it's not like, you know, in Quebec or, you know, where you have literally an implosion. There's just no evidence of that here. That the evidence we do see is that the folks in the middle do tend, to the extent they're gravitating, is not towards becoming more religious, but becoming less, or at least identifying themselves as less religious. So I think that hopefully, you know, you can say this on the importance of prayer. I've got, you know, several other things to say on that score. But that, in essence, is the response to the secularization theory. You know, some measures moving slightly downward, but the folks who are at the top in terms of religiosity, that figure does not seem to be budging.
Paul Fari. And then Paul Edward.
Luis, this is really interesting set of data that tells us about the bread box and the size and the shape of it. And my question is what do you do about the bread box? What is the answer or solution? What do you tell the bishops, what do you tell the pastors about their problem and the solution to their problem?
Nothing. I don't say anything about the solution to the problems because that would put me in a different mode, in an advocacy mode. We have a very strict non-advocacy position at the Pew Research Center. You will never find a set of recommendations at the end of our reports. Your question is an excellent one, Paul, but you missed it by a few hours because that's the gentleman that you ought to be addressing that to. Redeemer Presbyterian, what are church leaders doing to respond to this? I'm in the good position of saying, you got a problem, and God bless you as I leave out the door.
Tim, you want to jump in here on this at all? Feel free to break in. I'm going to
preempt yourself.
Jumped into the queue here.
No, I won't. I believe Luis's idea that all institutions have got a problem with expressive individualism. It's acidic, yes. I mean, in New York City, people are involved with the Philharmonic, for example. It's almost impossible to get people to come and stay for all four movements. The idea used to be that when you came to a symphony, you were part of a community and you were listening to it as a community, but that concept's gone. People will come for the ones they want to get, the movements they want. And they'll leave, and of course it's driving, the traditionalist kind of crazy, but I mean, that level, yeah. You see, all the way down to that level, it's a problem across the board. And I can get into more about how you respond as a religious institution to that. You can't ignore it or just give into it. That's all.
Yeah, Newport's thesis says that, yes, because of the boomers, we will become more religious, but it will be, we'll be differently religious. That is to say that, the forms of communal life in the faith, will need to be very different than they are today. Again, it's a tall order because these folks, as I'll conclude with that chart, they don't place a high value of being part of a moral community. They just don't. And it's for religious institutions and everything else. So I think, one of the challenges will be how do you, from the supply side of things, and there's an interesting discussion here. I mean, I hate to reduce it to economics, but there's the supply side and the demand side, of the argument here. On the demand side are people like, Rodney Stark and Roger Finke and others who say that on the supply side that religious institutions adapt, this is an entrepreneurial culture. They will come up with the kind of institutional arrangements that will draw these people back in. Then there's the supply side. Historians tend to be supply siders. They wouldn't call themselves that, but it's, look, we've had series of revivals in American history. What's not to say that there will be another major revival and then people will gravitate back? Newport is sort of like that. The demand will be so great from the boomers and others, the religious institutions in the U.S., in their entrepreneurial way, which they've always been, because they haven't had government support, you sink or swim here, in their own way, they will respond to that challenge.
Paul Edwards.
That actually, you've answered my first question, so I'll ask my second.
Okay.
Which is, Mary Eberstadt is coming out with a book next month about God and the decline of God in Western tradition. And she traces it very much to decline in family and family structure. And I'm just wondering if you have any data here or anything that you could point to that says something about family structure within the unaffiliated.
Glad you asked. Remember I said there were two demographic factors that buck the trend, remember, across economic groups, across educational groups, across regions of the country, the phenomenon is growing. The two that I signal out, one was race. We've already talked about that. It's heavily concentrated among whites. Here it is. The other one is, this is fascinating. I thought this was one of the most interesting results of our survey, which didn't get as much play, is among the not married. All of the increase, when you look at the marriage factor, all of the increase among the unaffiliated took place among those who are not married. No change at all among married Americans on affiliation. I think I'm increasingly convinced and really taken, and this goes from politics to everything else, that the two most important demographic changes happening in this society, one is, you know, the ethnic change, unquestionably. It's huge. And we Latinos have a lot to do with that. But also Asian Americans. Let's not forget, 5% of all Americans are Asian. The vast majority are immigrants. They're sort of forgotten in this discussion, but vitally important. But the second one is marriage. Absolutely critical in a variety of ways. Look at the marital status of religious groups. And this is what I'm talking about, that, you know, there may be something larger at play, and religious institutions are getting part of the blowback, but they're not primarily responsible for, although I'm sure you'll ask your pastor, what can you do about marriage rates, you know, and counseling and so forth, right? But it's very clear here. Look at the huge gap, despite the fact that our more religious group in the country, Black Protestants, are very, very low here. Very, very low. 60% of, this is adults now, African Americans, are not in a married relationship. It's really quite remarkable. So, but even despite that, look at the huge discrepancy. Religion is closely connected, you know, this is your point, but with family structure, no question about it. Now, married people are twice as likely as people who are not married to attend services weekly. I mean, it goes across the board. And you say, well, what is this presage? Gives me an idea, you know, to wrap up what I was going to say. Look at the falling marriage rates. I mean, talking about a profound demographic change. Marriage rates have fallen by 20 points in the last several decades. Unwed childbearing has become the new norm. More than 50% of babies are born to women under 30 are born outside of wedlock. I mean, it's a huge demographic change, which with strong implications, of course, for, you know, also material well-being, if you've been keeping up with that literature. The marriage, look at the median age of first marriage. I mean, millennials keep postponing, they keep going to grad school, keep postponing it. You know, you extend schooling, you postpone these things. So general aversion to marriage may signal, given how central that institution has been, a general aversion to lasting commitment of any kind, you know, including to religious institutions. I just think, look, even in politics, yes, there was a gender gap in the vote in the last election. What struck me as I poured through the exit polls was the marriage gap. There's the marriage and the ethnic gap between the two. Romney won among married women. And among white married women, it was no contest. You know, so is it a gender gap or a marriage gap? I mean, I think those things, you know, bear a lot more examination. But, well, I better stop there, well, Mike, before you wrap me on the knuckles here.
No, I won't. Amy Sullivan, and then and Dole and Sally, and John and David.
Sure. I first had a quick comment on Rebecca's initial question about kind of conflating religion and morality. Certainly a theory, and it's one I embraced in my book for the overall argument.
What's the name of that book again, Amy?
Thank you, Michael.
It's good.
The Party Faithful, How and Why Democrats Are Closing the God Gap.
The Party Faithful. Yeah.
And the argument is a politician's morality, and particularly a president's morality, was not something that voters particularly cared about for most of American political history until around the period of Watergate, when obviously it became an issue with Nixon. And it was just kind of historical chance that Jimmy Carter was the next Democrat to run and was also the most overtly religious presidential candidate that we'd had. And as a result, we kind of conflated religious identity and a sense of the moral compass of candidates. And we've never really moved on to find another measure for that. So that may be some of what people are getting at with the question of whether they want the president to be a religious person. But for my question for you, Luis, I wanted to repeat Paul Ferry's question in maybe a way that you are allowed to answer, which is, I know you have some data on the switchers. And I wondered if you could get into some of the reasons why people switch out of the unaffiliated group and tell you that they have joined a new tradition.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, remember, most of those folks were the figure I gave you were those raised unaffiliated. I mean, those who convert to being from affiliated to unaffiliated, yes, some of those folks come back. But the vast majority of them, you know, do not. Basically, what they tell us, remember, these folks, there is a significant percentage who are still, you know, quite spiritual, and it's primarily from those folks, you know, who tend to come back. A lot, if you look at the responses, a lot of that has to do with the search for community, actually, interestingly, which even if they don't value it for themselves. You saw that chart that I showed you. You know, even the unaffiliated say, "Yeah, we think religious institutions are important for community," and so they're still. I mean, they're conflicted about that. They personally don't, you know, feel a great need to go there, but they understand the importance of it. If I'm reading our numbers right, and so I think those are the kinds of things that these folks will point to. You know, at some point in their lives, they need something a little bit more structured than the do-it-yourself religiosity.
And is there a distinction between community being kind of just a community of people and providing, you know, a place for their children to go, or are we talking broader community like churches can help improve the common good?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, as I recall, most of them had to do with the former, you know, a more sort of immediate sense. Remember, these folks are still, you know, highly skeptical of religious institutions' involvement in public life. But they do see the importance of religious institutions for community more broadly, if that makes sense. So I think it's probably the former rather than the latter in terms of sort of joining up with religious institutions for major policy changes and so forth. We're not picking up.
No, but I'm thinking like feeding the poor and...
Yeah, well, they acknowledge that as well for, you know, in fact, that was the second thing that greatly valued, even among the unaffiliated, that kind of role.
Okay, let me tell you where we are. We need to take a 5 to 10 minute break. Then we're going to come back and we're going to be with Luis for another 30, 35 minutes. And then we have a 3 hour break for all of you all to visit the beach. And so we'll finish at 3:30. But if we could take just a short, less than 10-minute break just now and come back in, then Dole and Sally and John and David, everybody on this side is up, and we'll keep going.
If nothing else, all these numbers will prepare these people for cocktails, Mike.
Absolutely. That's at 6:30. But right, we come back in 10 minutes. Thank you. We have a robust list, but before we get to the list, though, if I could call on Dr. Keller. Tim, it'd be good to hear from a practitioner quickly here on, you know, you're in the heart of Manhattan, and you've got a thriving and growing church. How many switchers do you have in your church, or do you know? And what is your quick take on these numbers yourself, personally?
I think I said to you, I know... Pretty much, I was very happy with myself because I try to study the Pew numbers all the time. When those things come out, I read them very, very carefully. I could remember most of them, so I said, okay, all right, you've been keeping up. Absolutely, the main features and trends and the ideas, they resonate with what I see on the ground. The only thing maybe Mike wants me to share because I said something to him, as a practitioner, I can't help but... You can't help it when you're taking surveys. You have to try to make it as scientific as possible. So if you call up a Southern Baptist, a person is in from Arkansas, you know, he's 54%, you know, evangelical. Everybody goes to church. And Southern Baptists use all the evangelical language. You know, you're born again, you're everything. So But I personally, as a practitioner, I would see that person who is raised in a Southern Baptist church, tons and tons of them are not quite sure what they think about things. They're not particularly devout. They certainly would identify themselves as an evangelical, but I wouldn't see them a whole lot different than I was raised Lutheran. Most Lutherans, mainline Lutherans, are in that middle ground. They're in the middle. They're not over in the devout area, really, most of them. I would say that most Southern Baptists are there. I'm just, my experience as a spiritual director talking to people is that the Southern, a person sort of raised in any church that where the kids just say, I've got to go and I got to come, especially if it's a kind of place in town where, you know, everybody goes. They don't think it out and make it their own. They don't really appropriate it personally. I would think of most really devout conservative Protestants or Catholics, people have really thought it out and said, this is what I believe, and it's a matter of principle. And yet I see that an awful lot of those folks are in the evangelical. Anyway, I'm just trying to say, I feel like the numbers are basically right, but sometimes they seem soft to me, in that I'm sure that I can imagine you calling somebody up saying, are you an even, where do you identify yourself? And I say, sure, evangelical, because it's the tradition. Sure. But you know, I was raised Lutheran and became a Christian in college through, in the 1960s, reading John Stott and C.S. Lewis books. And when I came up with the idea of I'm born again, I had to think it out. It was an alien concept to me. I had to decide I was born again. And that's a very different way to come to evangelical convictions than being raised in a Southern Baptist church. So I look at those things and I wonder.
Yeah, I can make a point on that. It's an excellent point. And we actually reach that evangelical Protestant, just to stick with that designation, in two different ways. One is hugely expensive. We do it every so often. The U.S. Religious Landscape Survey back in 2007 did it this way. That is, we ask people, their denominational family. And then we backcode them. So if they tell us, you know, we don't ask them, are you born again? We ask them, you know, are you Southern Baptist? You know, so if they tell us they're Baptist, then we take them through a whole battery. And then subsequently, this is heavy duty, we assign them, you know, the denomination. If the denomination is evangelical, more broadly, we put them there. When you do that, you're absolutely right. You are going to have a percentage of those Protestants who belong to evangelical churches who tell us they are not born again.
Right.
All right? So when that's the heavy-duty way. And by the way, a fairly significant percentage, not a majority, but a significant, I think it was like 25% or so, of those who belong to mainline Protestant churches,
what
who
percentage?
Say they are born again.
What percentage?
Let me check, but I think it was 25 or so.
That would fit with my intuition. Yeah.
So, but again, these are surveys, 35,000 interviews. It takes us months and, millions. It's very, very expensive. So I'll share with you the shortcut way in which a lot of people do it. And that is, you ask people, are you Protestant? Of course, that's not enough anymore because you have to probe a little deeper, to put them into that category. But then you ask them a separate question. And are you born again or evangelical? You then use that question to assign people to evangelical churches as opposed to mainline churches. It's a shortcut which statistically happens to work because because the born again evangelicals among who belong to mainline Protestant churches actually cancel out the non born again people who belong to evangelical churches, and so it washes out. But that's the shortcut every pollster has to make. So what I'm telling you is, by definition, in many of these charts and political polling, when you see how evangelicals are trending, by definition, those are Protestants who describe themselves as born again or evangelical. But you're absolutely right. The reality is much more complex. But there, boy, I'm telling you, we can't send in the Marines. We have to send in a land army, to really get at that information.
Okay, Dole, you're up, and then Sally.
Thank you. I want to go back to the question of causality that several questions have gone to before. But to make sure I understand what your thinking is on it, and I hope this isn't just a case of every question has been asked, but not everyone has asked it.
Right.
You know, as you noted, Putnam in American Grace, Putnam and Campbell hypothesize, okay, maybe it's a backlash to the, against the Christian right. But I remember reading some earlier sociology that talked about a whole broad-scale disengagement from institutions of civic engagement in America by a guy named Bob Putnam, and it was Bowling Alone. And you've been kind enough to illustrate my question here with a slide. To what extent is it possible, and Dr. Keller, I think, alluded to this a little bit, that the rise of the nuns is just a subset of that much larger trend that churches are just like bowling leagues or symphony orchestras? What's your own working hypothesis?
Yeah. You know, I think as I put together all the accumulated data that I find the, you know, the former Putnam, that is the Putnam of Bowling Alone. Here's a, you know, the key chart from that. These are men and women's leagues and, you know, how they spiked, you know, the first part of the century and then have been on a tailspin ever since. I find that the most compelling. You know, much more compelling than the latter Putnam on the argument of backlash to politics, and I find it so for two reasons. One, I mentioned we just don't find that much direct evidence when we ask people why you're leaving that's what's driving it. For some, but not for the vast majority. It's a rounding error, you know, maybe 1% or something. Whereas I just see a lot of other things happening in the broader culture that seem to underscore that very powerful argument and Bowling Alone. This is the metaphor. But, you know, you can look at political parties. You know, both Democrats and Republicans have dropped 10 percentage points in the last several decades. And independents have grown by 20%. So, you know, you look at, you know, marriage rate, I think, is just, you know, a very, very good one. You look at trust in institutions, you know, they're all going down. The exception was the uptick, you know, for the military because it had gone down so far after Vietnam. But you know, all branches of government, including the Supreme Court, I mean, you got corporations, you got labor unions, I mean, Boy Scout, everything is going down. So I look at that evidence, I'm saying, man, oh, man. I mean, you know, religious affiliation is one of those areas of affiliation where it's also happening. Now, I tell you, Putnam finds that particularly alarming. Because I think I include here's confidence in organized religion. By the way, you can see a fairly steep drop. But this is a colleague of mine. They sought our input and we gave him some feedback at the Pew Internet Project. Lee Rainey. And what this clearly shows is that people who are active religiously are much more active across other institutions as well. Okay, that this is sort of all of one piece. In fact, I calculated this. Among those who are religiously active, who attend, you know, affiliate with religious institutions, they tend to belong to 5.61 other groups. Of those who aren't active in church groups, it's 2.11. So a significant difference. And Putnam, you know, he has stated this. He thinks faith communities, in fact, I'm quoting him, are arguably the single most important repository of social capital in America. So to the extent that that's declining, it may be part of a broader trend, but it's accelerating that trend, if his insight here is right. Speaking of Lee Rainey, by the way, he's also written a lot on how technology-enabled change is taking us increasingly away from tight groups into looser networks. So I think, you know, I don't have time to discuss it, but I don't have the expertise for it, but I think new forms of technology, I think, are part of this broader phenomenon.
Before I go to Sally, quickly on this point, Carl?
Yeah.
A follow-up to Doyle?
It's a follow-up, and it's also a follow-up what Luis just said. I read that book a long time ago, the Bowling book. It came out like 13 years ago. But I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the reasons, the basic reason people aren't bowling in leagues, they're watching television. That television was a big factor in keeping people at home and not going. And it got me wondering, Well, if people watch Joel Osteen on their TV, where do they count?
And that's a great.
I mean, you see his church is packed, but you know there's a lot more people watching on TV then.
Well, I was so impressed with Lee's analysis just on the role of technology and institutions more broadly that I said, Lee, you know what? We ought to do a survey together. And to see how the new technologies are impacting people's religious connections, where they get their information, et cetera. So we're going to do that one this year, Carl. So you're ahead of me.
You should be a part of that survey. Sally Quinn.
Yeah, I want to get back to Europe. My friend Karen Armstrong always tells me that when she lives in London, when she gets invited to a dinner party, the hostess will say rather hesitantly, but you must promise not to discuss God.
Right.
and so what is curious to me is why has Europe become so secular? Not just one country, but all of Europe become so secular. And when we're on the same educational level or intellectual or financial level, economic level, we are more secular. I mean, more religious. Why is it that Europe has become so secular, and why haven't we become? And are we going the way of Europe? And if we are, why?
Yeah. Again, excellent questions. Actually, Peter Berger, the great sociologist, who has spoken here, I think, on two occasions.
Yes.
Immigrant from Austria, eminent sociologist of religion, who actually changed his mind. You know, he sort of was tutored at the feet of European scholars, and so secularization was, and the more he looked at the evidence, the more he said, well, maybe we need to revise that. So he starts speaking about the desecularization. And Peter makes the point that, for many Europeans, the U.S. is what needs to be explained. He actually takes the contrarian view that it's European secularity that needs to be explained, because that's the exception. If you look at it from a broader global perspective, I often set up our good friends from Europe when they visit. I show them these measures for the U.S. and then for European countries, and they say, yeah, you're right. This confirms what we thought. You're all a bunch of religious fanatics. And then I broaden it and include, countries from Latin America, Africa, Asia, and the United States and Europe, and I say, who needs to be explained now? Because what's clear is that Europe, really stands out for its high levels of secularism in contrast to the rest of the world. And this is not unrelated to some of the debates about immigration in Europe, by the way. I mean, if these were all highly secular Muslims and Christians, by half of the immigrants to Europe are Christian, not Muslim, maybe there wouldn't be, that kind of, but it's a double whammy. It's both, Muslims coming in, and many of them are highly practicing Muslims, which offends European sensibilities, at least two counts. So it complicates the picture tremendously. Why have we avoided that? I really do think.
And are we avoiding it?
Well, at least we have avoided up until now. I think some reasons have already been suggested. I think that sort of the free market, we've never had established religion at the national level, which means in essence that, you have to, survive on your own. There's no government subsidies here to keep you going. So we really did establish with the First Amendment, a free market, and really as free a market probably as we've got. In religion. But it was also, there are many other things. I think immigration, subsequent wave of migrants have also tended to renew spirituality in this country in various ways. I think the role that historically faith-based organizations have played in, integrating migrants, providing social service, it's a sector that's always been much more vibrant than it has been in Europe, which tends to take a more, statist orientation. But then there's the other issue for many in Europe. Religious institutions were connected with the ancien regime, with the old order. Whereas in the United States, there has always been a strong connection of religion and progressive causes. Not just, more recently with conservative causes, but with progressive causes. which, you know, gives a very different, you know, flavor to that. It's not unlike Poland, let's say, and places like that, where the church was identified, you know, with the resistance movement to communism, you know, very different proposition when the church has aligned itself on that side. I see this in Latin America, my own native Cuba. Cuba became independent quite late, you know, almost 100 years after the rest of Latin America. And the Roman Catholic Church there was very much in league with the Spanish colonial authorities. In fact, most of the priests were Spaniards. And so it didn't take the Castro regime much effort, frankly, to decapitate it. Whereas I remember being asked at one of my talks at Ethics and Public Policy Center when the whole Central American thing emerged, whether Nicaragua was about to become another Cuba. And I said, I don't think so. I really don't. And that's quite apart from any ideological proclivity of the Ortega brothers. They may be quite in line with the Castro brothers on this, but the church in Nicaragua, my visits there, it was just very clear to me that Miguel Obando y Bravo, if I had to pick, you know, the most important person in Nicaragua, it was Miguel Obando y Bravo, the bishop. And so I said, you know, there's no way they're going to be able to decapitate, you know, the church there. And I think, you know, just on the side parenthetically, I think that may help to account why the Ortega brothers then begin to discover liberation theology. And it's sort of not a frontal attack, but a different kind of approach to the question. So, you know, might we be catching up? I don't know. Again, it's very early. I'm with Casey Stengel. I don't make predictions, especially about the future. I thought it was wise advice on his part. But we'll have to see, Sally. We're going to stay around to document it, though, however way it goes.
No, we'll do this again in a couple of years and see where we are. John Seneth, you're up next. Okay. And then David.
Okay. Luis, one of the things that stood out was the talk of the proliferation of the spiritual directors.
Right.
And I thought if this whole journalism thing doesn't work out, I may have a job after all. But it really brought me to the same place where Carl ended up, and maybe it's an unanswerable question, but it is that the search for community in 2013 is very different than the search for community in 1980 and certainly as late as 1990 and beyond. And I know you mentioned there's going to be a study that's going to look at that, but might the acceleration of the nuns be attributable directly to the acceleration of technology and social media and the fact that atheists and agnostics now have a place to go, and it's easy just at the, you know, at the tip of the keyboard, you can find that community without leaving your home?
No, I think, again, if I read the research done by my colleagues at the Pew Internet Project, I mean, it's akin to the first Putnam, you know, of bowling alone, that they see this phenomenon, you know, how technology-driven forces are breaking apart, you know, communities or institutions and creating networks. I mean, they are sort of quasi-communities, but obviously the price of entry and exit is a lot lower in these online communities. People just opt in and out all the time, so I'm not even sure we can call them communities, perhaps online networks. I have a strong hunch that that is part of what's going on, but again, we're gonna go deeper into that. That's not to say, by the way, that people who do have a strong religious commitment to religious community may not also be, you know, have a heavy presence online and to sort of supplement, you know, that communal experience. So again, we just don't have data on that stuff, so we'll have to dig it up.
David Bornstein.
Yeah, I had two questions. One of them was the slide that you showed before that started with Africa on the top left all the way down to Europe, and the U.S. is an outlier.
Right.
It reminded me of a slide that I saw in a book called The Spirit Level that looked at income inequality and how the United States was similarly, actually the graph looked very similar. I'm wondering if there's a crossover of this analysis with looking at income inequality and how it affects people's overall attitudes to institutions and particularly religious institutions.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You said you had two?
Yeah. And the other question is, I grew up in Quebec.
Oh,
and
right, so
I saw the implosion of religion in Quebec. I'm wondering, is there a flip side? What's the other side of the story, the city or the state or whatever, where you've seen the opposite of what has happened in Quebec? Is there a place in the U.S. where you've seen, like...
Well, I mean, if you want a continent-wide conversion like that, it's Africa in the 20th century.
But in the U.S.?
No, in the U.S., no. I think what when people talk about the greater presence, this is a very important distinction, greater presence of religion in public life, that doesn't necessarily signal a growth in religiosity, right? What it could signal is simply that those people who aren't religious have become more attached to their religious identity and insist that be given public expression. I mean, this is, in fact, what's been happening since the late 70s. I was telling somebody, I was a graduate school, my PhD work at the University of Chicago in the late 70s, studying international relations, and, I was being fed on textbooks that had, the European secularization theory and a variety of Marxist alternatives to it. They disagreed on many things. The one thing they did agree on was that religion would become increasingly privatized and irrelevant. And I'm picking up the front page of the New York Times, and I'm reading about the revolution, actually in Pakistan before Iran, which I remember the Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, it really caught me. I said, what's going on here? Sort of a top-down Islamic revolution, then Islamist, and then there's one in Iran. But at the same time, it's the rise of the religious right in this country in the late 70s. It's Likud in Israel, it's the BJP in India, it's this new pope who comes on the scene, John Paul II, and his connection with Solidarity, and I'm trying to articulate a Catholic basis for democracy in Latin America. Now, I'm looking at this and saying, man, there's a disconnect here between what I'm reading in the textbook and what I'm reading on the front page of so that, that really caused me to rethink the paradigms, as we call them in the academy, that I was being fed on, because I think it was so different. So please distinguish, I think, between the public emergence of religion on the one hand, and then whether religiosity is growing or not. I think that's a much tougher proposition. There is some evidence, particularly among Muslim groups, immigrant groups, that younger Muslims tend to be, somewhat more religious than older. They're bucking the trend, as it were. We found that in places like Russia in a big survey of Islam that we're going to release in a couple of months. So you do see, some of that. But I think primarily what you've seen in the last few decades is the public presence of religiosity on the scene. And I think the previous speakers pointed to why that may be, sort of the exhaustion of the old ideologies, whether it was pan-Arabism or, old secular ideologies, what I call the three insecurities in good Cuban Chinese fashion. There's a lot of insecurity afoot from economic dislocation, to global warming. I mean, there's a lot of secular apocalypticism going on out there, too. And cultural. I mean, I think, focusing on the question of gender and so is very much in line, because that's what seems to be changing the fastest, and it's very unsettling to a lot of people around the world. We tend to welcome it in the West. A lot of people don't, and I think a lot of those things have sort of driven people to rediscover, the public role of their religious identity. And for Islam, is particularly easy because Islam is inherently public. This Western Enlightenment notion of here's the public realm and here's the private, and religion belongs in the private, that's like coming from a different universe for most Muslims who understand the Muslim tradition, the Islamic tradition.
Now, that was the answer to a second question. What was the first one again, David?
If there's a relationship to income inequality or general social inequality in that curve that
Well, the big picture would suggest that, but if you looked at that chart that I showed in terms of demographics, it's happening across demographic groups in terms of income. You'll see that chart when I send it to you. I'll be glad to send it to you. And you'll see that it's happened among high-income, middle-income, and low-income Americans.
That's actually different because reference anxiety can be within the same income group. It doesn't. It's not something that.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Now, I think that's worth looking at much more carefully. The link between sort of economic dislocation and actually all of these things. From marriage rates to you name it. I think that's a critical factor that we have to consider when we look at broader social changes. I think undoubtedly the case. Now, Putnam is of the view, he's also optimistic, in Bowling Alone, in other writings, that look, we were at a similar juncture in the end of the 19th century in the transition from an agricultural to an industrial society that we are now from an industrial to a post-industrial to information society. And American institutions driven by faith-based institutions adapted to that and created a plethora of institutions to meet that particular challenge. You know, he's optimistic that this can happen again. That religious institutions and others will take up the challenge given this new economic dislocation of confronting that. So, he's very hopeful.
And you are?
I don't take a position, neither hopeful nor unhopeful. I'm not even for interreligious understanding, Mike. You understand that? Because that's to take a position on things, you know. We don't take a position on things.
The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life is a fact tank.
That's right.
Period.
That's right.
End of sentence.
That's right.
We only deal with facts. We draw the implications.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have no one else on the queue. And Sally has another question, and then we're going to take a three-hour break. So, Sally, it must be concise and to the point.
And I want to finish one last chart.
I want to go back to the slide that you showed about no difference between those who are nuns and those who are religious on how they think about the occult.
Ah, right.
The what?
How they think about the occult, astrology and psychic phenomenon, yeah, and the evil eye and all that. I'm wearing my evil eye bracelet right now.
Oh, there you go.
Okay,
there you go.
And several other trinkets. But I have found this, too, that so many of my friends who are really religious are, you know, have their charts read all the time. They read, you know, they wear trinkets and religious objects, and, you know, they do yoga and they go to psychics and all that. And people who are atheists do the same thing. And so I was just interested that you even included that in your survey.
Well, it's interesting how these things...
It was for you, Sally.
Yeah, now they segue into each other. You know, as we were beefing up our global polling, I knew that as we got into sub-Saharan Africa, where we did a major survey on religion, Latin America is next, even in the Muslim world, that's the big survey that's about to come out.
Well, the astrology particularly.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. And Hindus, yeah.
Yeah, so I was increasingly said, you know, we're going to find a lot of this kind of stuff going on. What scholars call syncretism, you can call blending of traditions. I said, you know, we ought to get a fix on how, you know, whether that's happening in the U.S., because people are always going to say, well, look at these people, how strange they are. And we ourselves were surprised, actually, the degree to which not the unaffiliated but affiliated Americans were finding ways of mixing and matching elements of very different religious traditions. And that's become, again, we backed our way into it, but it's become a topic of great interest to folks.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking Luis. You made the numbers come alive, Luis, and that's really a hard thing to do, especially in South Beach, Florida. We have a three-hour break at 6:30. Where we had lunch is where we have a reception, and then we have dinner there. Bring your name tags because we have table assignments again tonight, and they'll tell you where to sit on the back of your name tag. So enjoy the beach, ladies and gentlemen.